From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I've heard her position from others, which is get out of Iraq now. And it would be a mistake for the security of this country.
He doesn't have any children in harm's way. You know, if there's more soldiers or Marines killed today, he won't have to worry if one of them is his daughter.
President Bush won't speak with grieving mother Cindy Sheehan. But Thursday, he spoke about her as he rejected calls for a U.S. pullout from Iraq. We'll talk with Cindy Sheehan at Crawford. We'll look at the draft Iraqi constitution. Then, 70 years ago this weekend, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Social Security into law.
Seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session had done nothing more than pass this Security Bill, Social Security Act, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
Today we speak with the grandson of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and we'll look back at the Watts Uprising 40 years ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Bush emerged from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, Thursday and addressed for the first time the rapidly growing anti-war protest outside his property. What began as a one-woman vigil has now grown into the central anti-war action in the country. Before this week, there was very little coverage in the corporate media of anti-war families whose loved ones have been killed in Iraq. But now Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey was killed in Iraq, has grabbed international headlines by camping out in Crawford. President Bush mentioned Sheehan by name as he addressed reporters Thursday.
She believes this is America. She has a right to her position. And I thought long and hard about her position. I've heard her position from others, which is get out of Iraq now. And it would be a mistake for the security of this country and the ability to lay the foundations for peace in the long run if we were to do so.
President Bush has thus far refused to meet with Cindy Sheehan at his ranch, instead sending emissaries. Sheehan has vowed to remain in Crawford till Bush agrees to meet her. She has also indicated she may camp out at the White House once Bush returns from yet another vacation. He's taken more than 320 days of vacation since assuming the presidency 5 years ago. We'll go directly to Crawford in a moment, where we'll be joined by Cindy Sheehan. During his news conference, President Bush was surrounded by his top national security, foreign policy, and defense advisors. Bush seemed to indicate the new Iranian president will receive a U.S. visa to attend an annual United Nations gathering next month. There was some speculation that Bush may try to deny President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad a visa because of allegations he was connected to the 1979 seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. But after weeks of accusations against the new Iranian president, U.S. intelligence reports are now emerging that show there's no evidence for the charge. The Washington Post cites U.S. officials as saying Ahmadinejad actually may have opposed the takeover because of fears about the neighboring Soviet Union. A U.S. intelligence report also cites a speech by the new Iranian president from more than 6 years ago in which he publicly challenged the wisdom of the takeover. One U.S. official told the Post, quote, there is relative certainty he was not one of the actual captors. This story was on page 9 of today's, that's Friday's, Washington Post. Stories alleging Ahmadinejad was a hostage taker were front page news for several days after his election. In Iraq, Bush said he has made no decision on whether to increase or decrease U.S. troop levels there, calling reports of coming reductions speculation and rumors. But he did say that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's looking at whether to add troops at the time of the next scheduled Iraqi elections in December. Bush also predicted the draft constitution would be finished in time for a Monday deadline. Meanwhile, a leading Shiite lawmaker in Iraq has issued a call for a Shiite federal region just days ahead of that Monday deadline. The remarks by Abdulaziz al-Hakim came during a speech to cheering crowds in Najaf. Al-Hakim endorsed calls for a federated Iraq, saying federalism is needed to, quote, keep political balance in the country. The move could pave the way for a Shiite south and a Kurdish north. Those areas contain the lowest Sunni populations and the greatest oil wealth. We'll have more on Iraq later in the program. An Israeli soldier was sentenced by a military tribunal Thursday to 8 years in prison for manslaughter in the shooting death of British activist Tom Herndl, as Herndl was trying to protect Palestinian children. Tassir Habe was convicted by a military court in June for the murder of Herndl, who was shot in the head during an army operation in the Gaza Strip in April 2003. It was the first case in which an Israeli soldier has been found guilty of a crime in killing a foreign citizen during the past 4 years. Herndl's family immediately criticized the sentence as far too light given the crime. This is Herndl's mother, Jocelyn.
The Israeli Defense Force has a long way to go before they have any credibility in the eyes of the world. The world's eyes are on Israel at the moment. People are aware in the world of the ways in which the Israeli Defense Force treat civilians and kill civilians. They have a very long way indeed to go before we feel that we can trust their word, before we believe that they will carry out a thorough investigation.
Witnesses said that 22-year-old Tom Herndl was helping Palestinian children avoid Israeli tanks. He was in a coma for 9 months before dying in a London hospital. During his trial, Haib argued that a confession he gave was forced. Haib also said he was prosecuted because he's an Arab and because his victim was a foreigner. Tom Herndl was a member of the International Solidarity Movement, as was Rachel Corey, an activist from Olympia, Washington, who was crushed to death by an Israeli army bulldozer in March 2003. To this day, no one's been charged in her killing. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Israelis rallied in Tel Aviv today against Israel's plan to start pulling out of Gaza in 6 days. Opponents of the plan have stepped up their protests in recent days, vowing to sabotage the withdrawal operation. Back in this country, one of the key figures in the corruption investigation of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay has been indicted by a federal grand jury on fraud charges stemming from a deal to buy casino boats in 2000. Jack Abramoff is also under federal investigation in Washington by a grand jury investigating whether he and a lobbying partner overcharged Indian tribes by millions of dollars for their work. DeLay has asked the House Ethics Committee to review allegations that Abramoff or his clients paid some of DeLay's overseas travel expenses. DeLay has denied knowing that the expenses were paid by Abramoff, whom he once described as, quote, one of my closest and dearest friends. Abramoff collected more than $100,000 for President Bush's 2004 election campaign and raised thousands of dollars for DeLay and other Republican members of Congress. Now to Latin America. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights has rejected a request by U.S. citizen Lori Berenson to review its ruling that upheld her 20-year sentence in Peru for allegedly assisting anti-government forces and treason against the fatherland. It's reportedly Berenson's last formal avenue of appeal. In a decision issued in November, the Costa Rica-based court rejected Berenson's arguments that Peru violated her rights in a 2001 civilian retrial. Berenson and her family say she's innocent of any crime and that she was arrested because she opposed the government of Alberto Fujimori. She was tried by a hooded military judge and was not allowed to see any evidence against her. She's scheduled for release in November 2015, a few weeks after her 46th birthday. Just a day after a federal appeals court overturned the convictions of the Cuba Five, Miami's top federal prosecutor says he will retry the men who stand accused of espionage. The government says the retrial will likely happen next year and in a city other than Miami. But U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta also says he's considering appealing Tuesday's stunning decision by the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. That decision found that the original trial was unfair because it took place in the right-wing Cuban exile stronghold of Miami. Legal experts said the three-judge panel cited so much overwhelming evidence that there is nothing for prosecutors to challenge. Now back to news out of Iraq. An Iraqi official told reporters in Baghdad that Saddam Hussein could be executed after his first trial if he's convicted and sentenced to death for his alleged role in a 1982 Shiite massacre. The unnamed official said the first trial is expected to begin by the fall. He briefed reporters on condition his name would not be used for reasons of security and the sensitivity of the case. Meanwhile, Saddam's daughter has threatened that the ousted leader's defense lawyer could boycott the trial and preliminary questioning. unless the defense gets better access to Saddam. The defense has consistently alleged that it's only been allowed to meet Saddam with U.S. or Iraqi military officials watching. Meanwhile, Iraq's imprisoned former deputy prime minister, Tariq Aziz, was allowed a 10-minute phone call from his family on Thursday, his first such contact in over 2 years. His lawyer says Aziz will also be allowed a family visit next week. Aziz said through his attorney this week he would not testify against Saddam Hussein. Iraqi investigators have uncovered more cases of widespread fraud and waste. At issue are more than $1 billion worth of weapons deals arranged by middlemen who allegedly reneged or took huge kickbacks on contracts to arm Iraq's fledgling military. This, according to a confidential report obtained by the Knight Ridder News Service. According to the agency, the report by the Iraqi Board of Supreme Audit describes transactions suggesting that senior U.S.-appointed Iraqi officials in the Defense Ministry used three intermediary companies to hide the kickbacks they received from contracts involving unnecessary, overpriced, or outdated equipment. Last month, it emerged $300 million in defense funds had been lost, but the new report indicates the audit board uncovered a much larger scandal with losses likely to exceed $500,000. Last week, the Iraqi defense minister confirmed most of the audit board report's findings, saying that at least $500 million in Iraqi money essentially has disappeared. Many of the figures believed to be involved in the alleged corruption were appointed by the U.S. Occupation Authority, formerly known as the Coalition Provisional Authority. Texas has become the fourth state in the United States where white people have become a minority. The U.S. Census Bureau said Thursday this is part of a trend driven by a surging number of Latinos moving to the state. Texas joins California, New Mexico, and Hawaii as states with majority people of color populations. Five other states, Maryland, Mississippi, Georgia, New York, and Arizona, aren't far behind, with about 40% people of color. Many demographic experts say whites will be in the minority by the year 2050. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our viewers and listeners. On Thursday, one of the leading Iraqi Shiite politicians called for the nine provinces in the oil-rich southern portion of the country to become an autonomous Shiite region. The announcement has thrown the country's government into turmoil because it has increased the chance that legislators will be unable to approve a draft of a new constitution by the August 15th deadline. The Shiite politician, Abdulaziz al-Hakim, made the announcement one day after meeting with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the leading Shiite cleric. Hakim, who is the head of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution, spoke in Najaf before a gathering of thousands of Shiite supporters.
وأما بالنسبة لإقليم الوسط والجنوب فإننا نعتقد.
Regarding the central southern region, we think that it is necessary to form one entire region for central and southern Iraq due to the common characteristics of the residents of these parts and the unjust policies which were adopted against them. And we should not miss the chance to achieve this sacred target, and there should be constitutional guarantees to achieve this.
That was Shiite political leader Abdulaziz al-Hakim. The move could pave the way for a Shiite-controlled federation in the south and a Kurdish-controlled federation in the north. Sunni leaders have condemned the proposal, warning it could lead to the breakup of Iraq. It would block Sunnis from having access to most of the country's oil resources. This is Salah al-Mutlaq, a Sunni and a spokesperson for the Iraqi National Dialogue.
The statement has come to prove the fears of our Iraqi people and our fears that the purpose of federalism is to divide Iraq into ethnic and sectarian counties.
Sunni leader Saleh al-Mutlaq, the role of federalism and the balance of power between the Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish communities have been key sticking points during constitution negotiations. The U.S. had set an August 15 deadline for legislators to agree on a draft constitution. To speak about the current negotiations over the constitution, we're joined by Antonia Juhas. She is author of the forthcoming book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
It's great to have you with us. Antonia joins us in San Francisco. Can you talk about the Constitution? Though the draft has been seen, it's expected to be released on Monday, on the 15th.
Yeah, the first thing to say is that what has been released to the public has been very limited versions of the draft. So a lot of what we're talking about is a bit in the dark of what the exact text of the draft entails. But the negotiations have been pushed aggressively forward by the Bush administration, which is very intent on having that August 15th deadline met. But really quickly to say, the August 15th deadline, if it is not met, according to the transitional administrative law, the existing constitution, if the August 15th deadline is not met, then the National Assembly has to dissolve. So it seems highly unlikely that that deadline will not be met. The Bush administration wants to keep everything right on track so that it can show that it is achieving all of its stated goals in Iraq and that everything is moving along on schedule. One of the problems, however, is that the Bush administration has also been very good at making sure that its own particularly economic and political agenda remains on track in Iraq and will not be altered by the Constitution or the negotiations over the Constitution. And if the drafts that we've seen prove to be correct, that will probably be the outcome, unfortunately.
And what's been the role of the U.S. ambassador to Iraq on this issue?
Well, Khalilzad has taken a very upfront and aggressive stance in the negotiations, making it very clear that the fate of the United States is linked to the fate of Iraq and the outcome of the Constitution. The outspoken nature is fairly unique thus far. Khalilzad had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on Friday basically saying what the U.S. agenda for the Constitution was and making it very clear that the United States was going to continue to play an aggressive role in making sure that that agenda was met. The Bush administration has not been at all shy to make sure that the world knows that the administration intends for this Constitution to meet U.S. demands and to be done on a U.S. timetable.
There's been quite a bit of attention focused on the continuing debate over the role of women, but very little on the economic aspects of the proposed constitutional changes. Could you talk a little bit about what is going on in terms of the economy in the Constitution?
Yes, essentially what has remained almost off the table are the 100 orders put in place by Paul Bremer, the U.S. envoy to Iraq during the period of the formal occupation, which essentially transitioned all of Iraq's economic laws from a state-controlled economy to a market-controlled economy. These included provisions for the privatization of all of Iraq's state-owned industries, changes to trade laws, patent laws, banking, media, you name it, and it was transformed foreign investment so that foreign companies would have complete access to the Iraqi economy. There was an initial draft of the Constitution in Iraq that returned Iraq to a social welfare state, reflecting the original Constitution that had been in place during the Hussein era, which essentially guaranteed maternal and child health benefits, child care, the role of the state in guaranteeing education, that natural resources belong to the state, etc. That draft was essentially eviscerated, and the current draft puts all of that back into the market, and probably most importantly, makes the condition of natural resources far more more difficult to determine what the outcome is going to be for Iraq's oil. At the same time, as the negotiations are moving forward on the Constitution, an oil law is set to come into force in Iraq, a new national oil law that eliminates the nationalization, the state control of Iraq's oil, opens up the oil sector to private foreign investment, and essentially guarantees the ability of U.S. companies to have, at minimum, significantly greater access to Iraq's oil.
Antonia, can you talk more about women in Iraq? Interestingly, in our next segment, we'll go to Cindy Sheehan, the American mother who's sitting outside President Bush's ranch, whose son Casey died in Iraq. You talk a great deal about women in Iraq, what their situation is today.
Well, the situation for women in Iraq is tenuous, but one of the issues that's, I don't think, addressed enough is the fact that because the U.S. reconstruction has been so biased towards U.S. corporations and not focusing on what Iraqis need, the conditions with the lack of water, the lack of electricity, the lack of health care, of course, falls disproportionately onto women and the need to provide those resources themselves and to make sure that their families have access to those resources. So women in Iraq, lives have been more dominated by the need to just meet their basic family subsistence needs. Women's rights in Iraq under Hussein had been some of the best, certainly in the Middle East, and had been guaranteed, as I said, under the Hussein-era constitution. Now much of that is very much up in play as the negotiations seem to have be putting significantly more attention onto Islamic law. There is, however, a very powerful women's rights movement in Iraq that is fighting very aggressively to stem that tide. And that is certainly an issue that is still up in the air, and we'll have to wait until Monday to find out what happens.
What about these calls for Shiite autonomy in the south? What do you see as the prospects for that or for that scuttling the entire constitution, the effort to get it out by Monday?
As I said, I find it would be very difficult to see the Constitution not being completed on the 15th, as those in power do not want to lose power by having the entire government dissolved on the 15th. What I think the Shiite call is for is how will federalism be defined in Iraq? The Kurds have made very clear that they want to have their own autonomous region. These are not proposals for the dissolving of Iraq into separate countries. It's more along the lines of how will the lines of the regional authority be determined. So the Sunnis are certainly very concerned at the idea of essentially Iraq's oil being put into the hands of the Shiites in one region and the Kurds in another. However, you could still have federal authority divided along the very same lines that are being put forward by the Shiites right now, and have a national law that would distribute the oil wealth in a fair manner and authority over the oil in a fair manner. I think what we're seeing right now is in the days leading up to the conclusion of the negotiations, each of the power bodies at play in Iraq stating their most aggressive and desired stance so that they will be on record for that. And then whatever happens on Monday happens on Monday. And then there's a several-month process before October 15th when a referendum will be had on the Constitution, in which hopefully a public debate will be able to be had, and the public will therefore be informed on the positions of their political leaders. I think for any of that to make any sense and to actually move forward in any sort of democratic means, the U.S. military invasion and the economic invasion will have to end for there to be any real discussion to see what these positions really mean and what the public really has at its access to have any sort of say in what the Constitution will ultimately mean for them.
Antonia Juhas, I want to thank you very much for joining us in San Francisco. She is author of the forthcoming book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Cindy Sheehan joins us. She's sitting outside President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the music Tuxedo Moon. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the story of Cindy Sheehan. A year and a half ago, Sheehan's oldest son, Casey, was killed in Iraq. He was 24 years old. Sheehan is now in Crawford, Texas, taking part in a vigil near President Bush's vacation ranch. She has asked for a meeting with the president, but so far the White House has said no. Now she is threatening to stay in Crawford until the president grants her a meeting.
And if I have to stay out here all month in this heat, it's not anything compared to what our soldiers are going through and what the people of Iraq are going through.
On Thursday, President Bush was asked about Cindy Sheehan.
Listen, I sympathize with Mrs. Sheehan. She feels strongly about her position. She has every right in the world to say what she believes. This is America. She has a right to her position. And I thought long and hard about her position. I've heard her position from others, which is get out of Iraq now. And it would be a mistake for the security of this country and the ability to lay the foundations for peace in the long run if we were to do so.
Cindy Sheehan's protest has generated headlines around the world. Military families from around the country are heading to Crawford to join her vigil. Meanwhile, she's come under attack by right-wing websites and commentators. Earlier this week, Bill O'Reilly of Fox News suggested that Cindy Sheehan has committed treason.
I think Mrs. Sheehan bears some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
Bill O'Reilly. Well, we're joined now on the phone from Crawford, Texas, by Cindy Sheehan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. We're also here with Juan Gonzalez. Can you talk about President Bush's statement yesterday and what your demands are?
Well, I want to know what the noble cause is that Casey, the supposed noble cause that Casey died for. You know, I don't believe a war of aggression against a country that was no threat to the United States of America, dying for that is a noble cause. I don't believe sending our children to die for something like that is a noble cause. I would like him to tell me if he thinks it's such a noble cause, does he encourage his own daughters to enlist and go over there and take the place of some soldiers who might want to come home? And then another thing, he always says that we have to honor the sacrifices of the fallen by completing the mission. Well, you know what? I don't want him to use Casey's death to justify his killing anymore. And his press conference yesterday, he said, I have his sympathy. I don't want his sympathy. I want answers.
And your response to the fact that now more people are joining you there outside of the ranch in Crawford?
We had over 700 people come through our camp yesterday, and we are expecting thousands this weekend. It is just so incredibly amazing to me. I think people in America just needed a way to stand up and have their voices count. And for some reason, this is the way for them to do it.
Cindy Sheehan, the Drudge Report has been leading a campaign against you, along with Bill O'Reilly. And one of the points they make is that when you first met with President Bush, you came out with a very different impression, satisfied with the meeting, they say. And then you changed your tune. And they also talk about dissent within your family about what you're doing.
Well, for one thing, June of 2004 and August of 2005 are two different months, or 14 months apart. And in June of 2004, we had buried Casey 9 weeks before when we met with the president. I was still in a deep state of shock and a deep state of grief. And I'm still in a deep state of grief, and I will be for the rest of my life, thanks to George Bush. But I'm not in shock anymore. And I have informed myself, and I have known that four different reports have come out proving that this war was based on deceptions and lies, and it's for greed, and not one person should be dead. My son shouldn't be dead, and the killing shouldn't continue. Every day people are dying, and we need to get our troops out of there right now. And dissent within my family the members of my family that wrote that letter are my in-laws. We have never been politically on the same page. But you know what? These people, I think, are using Casey's death because they didn't know Casey. They didn't have a relationship with Casey. They didn't go out of their way to get to know him. They never spent time with him. And they can't speak for Casey. I can speak for Casey. My children and Casey's father, the five of us are all on the same page, united in our message of this war was a mistake and we need to bring the troops home.
Will you continue the protest? If you don't, if President Bush doesn't meet with you in Crawford, will you go to the White House and continue?
We're planning on going to the White House and setting up a 24-hour vigil until the troops are brought home.
Has anyone else from the White House, other than Stephen Hadley, when he came out to talk with you, have they attempted to communicate with you or in one way or another dissuade you from your protest?
No, not me. They haven't talked to me.
What does it feel like to be discovered by the media right now? I mean, you've been extremely outspoken for quite some time now. What do you think happened? What is different right now?
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I keep telling everybody. You know, I keep telling them I didn't just crawl out of the woodwork on Saturday, you know, because they say, oh, you're so articulate. How can you do this? You're very well spoken. You handle the media. You act like you're an old pro. I say I am an old pro. I've been doing this for months. You know, everybody in the progressive media and the progressive circles, I'm a very well-known figure. And I've been on your show many times, Amy. You know, I've been doing it a long time, and I don't know why. I think it was just a good idea at a good time, and I never thought of this when I started, but the press is always with the president, and they're here in Crawford, Texas, and, you know, they always look for something to cover, something to do. And you know what? This is the right thing at the right time.
And the fact that the president spends so much time every year at Crawford, Texas, and at the ranch there, any response from you on that?
I think it's an obscenity. You know, I think he takes 5 weeks off, the longest vacation a president has ever had, and he has troops suffering in Iraq right now. And you know what? Because of him, I'm never going to fully enjoy another vacation. There's always going to be a hole in my life, a hole in my heart, and it is caused by him. And I hope this is putting a little crimp in his vacation.
Cindy Sheehan, are you calling for people to come to Crawford to protest? Are you calling for a massive protest?
Well, that's what we've been calling for. It's starting to scare me a little bit because that's what's happening. There's people coming from all over the country and all over the world to stand in solidarity with us, and I think it's what needs to happen, though, because, you know, 62% of America think this war is a mistake and want our troops to come home, and the media and the government need to see the numbers, need to see that we mean business, and I just think that this is just totally spontaneous, and people have told me they've dropped everything to get in their car and get down here. And to me, it's just amazing. People are tired of what's going on in this country, and they're standing up and saying, enough is enough. I want my country back, and we want our troops home.
Has President Bush's girls come to visit him? Have his two daughters at the ranch
come down to visit us?
Yes.
No.
Or him, have come to
All
visit.
Him, you know what? I don't know. They don't go by us. They fly in helicopters. So, you know who keeps us well abreast of what's going on up there? So whatever we need to know is the media.
Well, Cindy Sheehan, we thank you very much for being with us. We will continue to visit you on your lounge chair in Crawford, Texas, just outside the ranch. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we move on to a very important anniversary, Juan.
Yes, well, this Sunday marks the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Social Security Act. President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the act into law on August 14, 1935. Social Security was the centerpiece of his New Deal program and included benefits for the elderly, the retired, and the unemployed. Here is President Roosevelt speaking at the signing of the act.
Today, a hope of many years standing is in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what would be their lot when they came to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long the job would last. This social security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health. We can never insure 100% of the population against 100% of the hazards and vicissitudes of life, but we have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age. It seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session had done nothing more than pass this security bill, Social Security Act, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
That was President Roosevelt at the signing of the Social Security Act in 1935. Special thanks to our partners at archive.org for preserving this public history. Well, today, President Bush has made overhauling Social Security a centerpiece of his second-term domestic agenda. Bush has advocated privatizing portions of the program, claiming it's the only way to save the system from bankruptcy. But he's encountered fierce resistance from both Democrats and Republicans, and his proposal for instituting personal accounts died in the House last session. However, earlier this week, Bush met with economic advisors to strategize ways of pushing through his plan for privatization when Congress returns in the fall. The latest poll conducted by the American Association of Retired People found 86% of non-retired Americans think Social Security should continue as a government program. We're joined in our D.C. studio now by James Roosevelt, Jr., the grandson of FDR and president and CEO of Tufts Health Plan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Your thoughts on the 70th anniversary of the signing of Social Security into law?
Well, Amy, this 70th anniversary of the signing of the Social Security Act this Sunday is a real celebration because Social Security has been so successful in accomplishing its goals, and it continues to be. And the projections of all economists, including President Bush's own economists, indicate that it has every prospect of continuing to be successful right through the 21st century.
And your sense of President Bush's attempts now to, quote, save Social Security by the privatization of a portion of it?
Well, the White House and President Bush and Republican leaders in Congress have admitted that the president's proposal does nothing, not 1 cent, to extend the solvency of Social Security. You know, if no changes were made in Social Security, the current projections by the White House and the Social Security Administration show that it would be fully solvent through 2041, and then only a 25% cut in benefits would be required to keep it solvent through the rest of the 21st century. So President Bush's proposal is not really an overhaul. It's really a destruction of Social Security. And it would take this program, which has moved America's senior citizens from 1950, when 48% of retired Americans lived below the poverty line, to where we are today, where only about 8% are below the poverty line. And that's because nearly two-thirds of retired Americans get the majority of their income from Social Security, and one-third of retired Americans get all of their, virtually all of their income from Social Security. This program has worked, It's been tweaked every 15 or 20 years. It could stand to be tweaked sometime in the next few years to extend its solvency, but not destroyed the way President Bush wants to do.
James Roosevelt, can you talk about what you understand took place at that time? The New Deal, your grandfather's feelings at that time as his grandson. You weren't alive then.
I was not. I got to know my grandmother, Eleanor, growing up. She lived till I was a senior in high school, but I didn't know my grandfather. But through her, I do know that that was the Great Depression. Because of my grandfather's polio, a lot of the observations around the country were done by my grandmother, Eleanor Roosevelt. She would come back and tell him about the tremendous poverty that she saw, partly among active working people, and that's why the Social Security Act included unemployment compensation. People forget we didn't have that transitional assistance for people before Social Security. But partly because the poorest people in that time of great poverty were the elderly and the young. Social Security provided for a basic, secure retirement income, and it then provided, and still provides today, very important benefits for children of parents who are either deceased prematurely or become disabled prematurely. A large percentage of Social Security benefits go to survivors and children. 10 million Social Security recipients are below the age of 65. So they looked at those serious national problems and came up with a program with a dedicated income stream from the payroll tax that isn't in competition with other worthy needs from defense to education, but instead says this is what you can count on. And that's what Social Security is about, rather than being speculation in the stock market.
And your sense of the ability of the Republican leadership in Congress and the president to emasculate or destroy this final bulwark of the New Deal that your grandfather represented?
Well, it certainly is clear that the American people do not support the privatization that would destroy Social Security. And as you indicated in the introduction here, even Republicans have joined with Democrats in the House and Senate to oppose the president's privatization proposal. However, it seems that when President Bush and Vice President Cheney get a bad idea, they just stick to it. And they use words like crisis and bankruptcy and flat broke when they just aren't true at all. So that kind of psychological warfare on the basic economics of the average American is something that you can't just ignore. All Americans, I think, have to continue to talk to our senators and our representatives about how deeply we feel about this program, which is America. Really, it's America's family program, because it means that working younger people don't have to be concerned that their parents and their grandparents will need their income out of their weekly paycheck in order to eat and have shelter. And it means that they can count, working Americans can count on a basis of a solid, secure retirement when they get to retirement age or if they should become prematurely disabled.
James Roosevelt, Jr., I want to thank you very much for being with us, the grandson of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, on this 70th anniversary of the signing of Social Security into law. When we come back from our break, another anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the Watts Uprising. Stay with us.
Tell me, brother, have you heard from Johannesburg?
Johannesburg. Gil Scott-Heron here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, this week marks the 40th anniversary of the Watts Rebellion. 40 years ago yesterday, the South Central neighborhood of Watts, Los Angeles, erupted into 6 days of rioting after a white traffic officer stopped a black man, accused him of drunk driving, and crowds gathered as officers began beating him with their batons. The Watts uprising shepherded in a new, more militant era of the civil rights movement as African Americans took to the streets in a mass protest against white economic exploitation and police brutality. But mainstream media coverage at the time portrayed the uprising only as lawless and destructive. There was little attempt to understand the reasons behind the rebellion, and there were virtually no interviews with rioters themselves. In fact, at the time of the riots, the LA Times did not have one black reporter on its staff. We go now to a news report from that era.
6 days of rioting in a Negro section of Los Angeles left behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities. More than 100 square blocks were decimated by fire and looters, and few buildings were left intact. Firemen were harassed by snipers and brick-throwing hoodlums as they attempted to control the fires, many of which were left to burn themselves out. As the National Guard moved in to restore comparative calm, the losses by fire alone were put at $200 million. No attempt has yet been made to estimate the losses suffered at the hands of the looters, who stole everything from liquor to playpens. Firemen were later issued flak suits of bulletproof mesh to protect them from snipers who continued to shoot from rooftops. Nearly 3,000 were arrested, and authorities had to open abandoned jails to house those netted by the police. It took the appearance of 14,000 troops to bring an end to what both Negro and white leaders called insurrection by hoodlums. Civil rights leaders were quick to deplore the unbridled lawlessness, and Martin Luther King vowed to do all in his power to prevent a recurrence in Los Angeles or anywhere. An uneasy calm prevails in what is known as the Watts area of the city. A curfew was put into effect, and the entire section declared off limits to all but residents. The people who live here are suffering great hardship, with no grocery, drug, or other service stores able to operate. A special task force of 1,000 policemen stays on the alert as the thousands of guardsmen patrol an area of 35 square miles. The outbreak spread to other Southern California cities, but were quickly quelled. And Los Angeles authorities say they are now ready to move with dispatch if lawlessness breaks out anew. The riots in Los Angeles have written a sorrowful page in American history.
That was a Universal Newsreel report from 1965 about the Watts Rebellion. We now go to a Pacifica documentary about the uprising that was also produced then, entitled The Fire This Time, produced by stations KPFA and KPFK.
The chief of police, I've seen him on television these last few days, trying to blame the whole thing on agitators. Parker said, well, agitators have been going into that neighborhood for 2 years and telling those people they're deprived. And so naturally they're beginning to believe them. My God, does he really believe these people are so stupid that they don't know they're deprived until agitators tell them so?
If you look at the TV and the radio coverage, if you look at the newspaper coverage of this event, the entire press coverage, with almost no exception, is white. Here we're talking on TV where we look at face after face after face covering this Negro revolt, and there isn't a Negro face discussing it. We get this all filtered through white minds, white thinking, white experience, white relationships, and let's face the most important fact, white fears. White fears of the Negro, of what the Negro will do, of where the Negro will move, and of course, always in the back of everybody's mind, would you like one to marry your daughter? And let's not forget this. This is the big, ridiculous bugaboo, the fetish.
Now look, a white man in Mississippi will go with a color woman. But you let a color man, look how they did for Emmett Till. He whistled at a low class white woman, they
say.
And they how they found him. They found him, he was dating.
That's right.
And he wasn't 15 years old. If a white man can go with a color woman, why can't a color man go with a white woman? She ain't no better than us. That's right.
Yeah.
We are born equal. At least many of us believe that we are born equal. But yet, the Negro is expected to behave in a superior manner. Remember, the churches were bombed. The news media brought it to our teenagers. Young children were killed in a church at Sunday school. The snipers killed Medgar Evers. Now, when snipers are shooting, you know, it's wrong. But yet, the Negro is supposed to behave in a superior manner and supposed to see the difference. Hoses and dogs were turned on the people in Alabama. But yet, we are supposed to live with this and have no feelings about it and at no time show any resentment.
All I got to say is burn what burn the motor.
You can't even get a job around here, not a decent job. All right, they hired my mother as a cook. She cooked for a white woman almost 15 years, but yet and still, she's not good enough to come through the front door, go to the back door, and this and that. Well, she had to do it because she had us to take care of.
If they treat us right, we'll treat them right.
That's right. I'd be willing to live next door hand in hand with a white man.
Yeah, to be brothers and sisters.
That's right. If they treat us just like we're supposed to be treated, like we're human and not dogs.
There was a great deal of destruction of property, a great deal of rock throwing, a great deal of bottle throwing, a great deal of Molotov cocktail throwing. There was some very professional arson done out there that I saw firsthand. But there were relatively few people killed, and most of them, I think almost 10 to 1, that the people killed were colored. Now, these people are armed out there in the ghetto. They have certainly an adequate number of firearms. They have adequate ammunition. They looted scores of pawn shops in order to get these guns, sporting goods stores, war surplus stores. They have hunting rifles. They have their own pistol. Why was it that so few people got killed on the side of the police? This strikes me as being a violent protest, but not necessarily a murderous insurrection, because the casualties don't look right.
We wonder how the normal, deprived person reacts when you're hungry, you're overcrowded, you have no hope. Some people commit suicide. Others must learn how to handle it and must not show it in any way. They must be patient. They must wait. How much can you be deprived?
You start in Alhambra and go through Los Angeles and drive straight down Mission. You'll run through a Mexican neighborhood for 10 miles. And when you leave that Mexican neighborhood, you'll run into a color neighborhood. And you'll stay in that color neighborhood until you get out of the city of Los Angeles. You'll drive 20 miles. And that the white people have abdicated the central part of Los Angeles to Negroes and Mexicans. There are 1.5 million of them. And there is no race riot, because if there were a race riot, they would burn down the city of Los Angeles.
How come they can't do us like they do the whites? Huh? How come they can't do us like they do the whites?
It's not only the police department, man. It's every other police department.
It's the police department.
When I said last year this was going to happen, everybody said I was an alarmist, but I said that if the police continued in their course of behavior, we were going to have exactly this event. The only problem was when.
The intersections littered with debris from glass, from accidents, cars that had been abandoned and gutted by fire lying in intersections. A scene of complete and utter pandemonium spreading faster and faster throughout the ghetto.
Pacifica documentary on the Watts Uprising. As we turn now to Gerald Horn, author of the book, The Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising in the 1960s. Juan?
Gerald, welcome, and your thoughts 40 years later.
Well, sadly and unfortunately, Juan, some of the causes of those that civil unrest of 1965 are still with us. First of all, deindustrialization, offshoring, the fleeing of jobs, which leads to despair, that's still with us. Police misconduct, police brutality, that was what lit the fuse in 1965. I'm afraid that's still with us as well. So as we go into the 21st century, I'm afraid 40 years later, after August 1965, the basic conditions that led to the then largest episode of unrest in this country to that time, those causes are still with us.
You wrote a whole book, Fire This Time, Gerald Horn. What captivated you about, what did you feel was most important about the Watts Uprising?
Well, in part, it was the ideology that came out of those events. That is to say, August 1965 is a hinge moment in terms of U.S. history. With August 1965, you see the efflorescence, you see the rise of a certain kind of masculinist black nationalism. You also see the rise of a certain kind of activism. It's from August 1965, those ashes, that you see the rise of the Black Panther Party, an organization which, of course, was emulated all across the globe. It's with August 1965, I'm afraid, as well, you see the rise of a pattern of mass incarceration. Note that in that documentary you just broadcast, they talked about how they felt they had a dearth of jails. And it was with that particular moment that you see this expansion of what has now come to be known the prison industrial complex, which, of course, has led to the incarceration of a generation of African-American males in particular, and now is sweeping within its ambit African-American women.
Gerald Horn, I want to thank you very much for being with us, author of Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising and the 1960s.
Well, Amy, I understand that you are heading up to Columbia University this afternoon.
That's right, Juan. As we wrap up this week's shows, I head up to the Pulitzer Board at the Columbia Journalism School today at 11 o'clock to submit a request for the New York Times to be stripped of their 1946 Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Their reporter, William Lawrence, also on the payroll of the U.S. War Department. That'll be at 11 o'clock at the Columbia University gates at 116th Street and Broadway. Looking forward to seeing reporters there. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Neil Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can get further information on Hiroshima coverage, the Watts Uprising, the Iraq Constitution, and much more. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.